content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's issue of Time is dated August 24, 2020. The cover photo, which is illustrated by Tim O'Brien for Time, features a pale blue sky in the background. At least half the page is under the Time indicia. There's a White House in the background. It's half flooded with water. It's as if an ocean has encountered the White House. Someone in a dark blue suit jacket, we see only the person's head and shoulders, is swimming toward the White House. The person has long, blondish hair. It is a man, and the hair is not shoulder length, but it's longer than a crew cut or a buzz cut would be. And surrounding the swimmer are these red orbs that resemble the coronavirus depictions as seen in publications. Beginning with Time's brief opener, and the world, tick-tock on the chopping block, by Charlie Campbell, Shanghai. First they went after Huawei, then it was gummy bears singing Adele, tick-tock. The social media platform where primarily Gen Z users share dance routines and zany memes involving pruning fruit candies and the like has become the latest flashpoint in the escalating tech war between the U.S. and China, with President Donald Trump threatening July 31 to ban the app on national security grounds. U.S. government experts warn that TikTok, that is spelled T-I-K-T-O-K, the U.S. subsidiary of Beijing-based ByteDance, and that is spelled B-Y-T-E, dance, could be used to spread misinformation and funnel user data to the Chinese state. In response, ByteDance CEO Zhang Yiming insisted his firm fully respected user data security, platform neutrality, and transparency. But seeing the writing on the wall, ByteDance has moved to sell TikTok to Microsoft after the latter's CEO, Satya Nadella, received assurances from Trump. A deal for the estimated $50 billion app would have to be completed by September 15, but has sparked a backlash in Beijing after Trump said the U.S. Treasury should receive a substantial portion of any agreed fee because we are making it possible. Hu Jijing, the outspoken editor of Chinese Communist Party, CCP, mouthpiece The Global Times, decried the prospective sale as open robbery. It is just the latest salvo between the world's two biggest economies as relations disintegrate. Beyond tech supremacy, Beijing and Washington are feuding over trade tariffs, the detention of 1 million ethnic Uyghur Muslims in China's Xinjiang region, the erosion of freedoms in semi-autonomous Hong Kong, and the militarization of the South China Sea, not to mention origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. This administration fundamentally believes that the Xi Jinping government poses an existential threat to U.S. national security, says Sam Sachs, cybersecurity policy and China digital economy fellow at New America Think Tank. Large Chinese companies are in the crosshairs, and then it's a moving target what the specific risk is. The risk with TikTok is very different from that presented by the telecom giant Huawei, which the Trump administration has targeted with sanctions and encouraged allies to blacklist. Huawei is a market leader in building 5G infrastructure and security concerns on communications networks are self-evident, though in Huawei's case unproved. The fear with TikTok appears to be that Beijing could pair data gleaned from the app with information already harvested in hacking on U.S. citizens, allegedly sponsored by China. As a national security argument, it is pretty weak, says Adam Siegel, a cybersecurity expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. The reality is the Trump administration is acting primarily on commercial concerns, he says. TikTok is the first social media platform out of China that became truly global. Banning TikTok would be an escalation, but in keeping with a broader sense of economic disengagement between the rival superpowers. In recent years, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States has ramped up blocking Chinese acquisitions of U.S. strategic assets. The Trump administration is also threatening to delist Chinese firms trading on U.S. bourses that fail to properly disclose financial information. For Orit Frankel, a former official at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative who's worked on Asia trade policy for more than three decades, it's a marked change of attitude. 20 years ago, no one foresaw things moving in this direction, she says. To descend into a full-fledged Cold War would be extremely unfortunate. Responsibility also lies with Beijing, which, on top of compelling private firms to aid national security matters, shrouds its economy in red tape and still denies access to Facebook, Twitter, Google, and many other U.S. firms. The question is now not whether decoupling of the two economies will happen, but how far it will go and who will be targeted next. Chinese tech giant Tencent, that's one word, is a major investor in Reddit, for one. Wanda Group owns AMC Cinemas and Hollywood studio Legendary Entertainment. PR representatives of Chinese companies are terrified of courting American markets, lest, as one recently told Time, we become the next Huawei. Or TikTok, it seems. Analysts are now watching to see if Beijing retaliates against U.S. firms with a strong China presence, such as Apple, Microsoft, or Intel. That danger is real, says Frankel. We have seen this kind of tit-for-tat over past years in the U.S.-China relationship. The relationship has not looked so rocky in decades. Each side has closed a consulate belonging to the other and expelled journalists. The U.S. has banned Chinese graduate students with ties to the military and piled sanctions on officials over human rights abuses in Xinjiang. A proposal to ban all 92 million CCP members and their families from entering the U.S. is gaining traction. So, what does the U.S. gain from this multi-front blitzkrieg? Some suspect China hawks are punishing Beijing before November, mindful of Trump's plummeting polls and the prospect of a Biden White House seeking to build bridges. Some in the administration want to burn as much down as possible, Siegel says, so that it's very hard to reset the relationship. Beneath the bulletin, Europe's last dictatorship faces challenge from a novice. This is by Madeline Roach. Europe's longest-serving leader, Alexander Lukashenko, is facing an unprecedented challenge as he runs for a sixth term as president of Belarus in elections August 9. A former teacher with no political experience, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, has emerged as the main rival, pledging to restore democracy. For the first time in his 26-year rule, Lukashenko knows the majority do not support him, says Alexander Feduka, a former aide to the incumbent. Belarusian bully Lukashenko has ruled the former Soviet republic of 9.5 million people since 1994. His regime was dubbed Europe's last dictatorship by President George W. Bush in 2005, and he's jailed opposition leaders, repressed independent opinion polls, and held elections deemed severely flawed by the European Parliament. Now anger has mounted over his mishandling of COVID-19 pandemic. He dubbed it a psychosis that could be cured by vodka. A decade of economic stagnation and financial dependence on neighboring Russia, which many citizens see as a threat to sovereignty. Tikhanovskaya entered the race when her husband, Sergei Tikhanovsky, a popular YouTuber who led rallies against the regime, was jailed in May. Backed by opposition figures, Tikhanovskaya has brought record crowds to rally in support of her three pledges: to free political prisoners, reverse authoritarianism, and run new free elections within 6 months. Police have responded with heavy-handed tactics, arresting more than 1,000 protesters, according to the Minsk-based human rights group Vyasna. The incumbent will almost certainly claim victory through a fraudulent election with vote rigging and ballot stuffing, analysts say, but his battles won't end there. Protesters have no intention of backing down, says Matthew Freer, an expert on Belarus at Leiden University, and a weakened Lukashenko will find it far more difficult to resist Kremlin influence. If he cracks down on dissent, he'll lose the chance of turning to the West, leaving him with no choice but to work with Moscow. Here's a photo. It's in color, but it's mostly in gray. There's a line, not a straight line, running up from the bottom to the top in the middle of the photo. And it's grayish, tannish brown, like a gravel road or a light-colored dirt road. On either side of this road, there are splotches of color, white and blue and green and pink and red and orange. They are buildings. They are very closely set together. It looks almost like an old-fashioned tourist camp where the cabins were quite close to one another but not adjoining. The caption reads, "Rising Toll, T-O-L-L. Cemetery workers carry the coffin of a person who died of COVID-19 for burial at a cemetery on the outskirts of Lima, July 8. The four people dressed in black are carrying a coffin down the middle of this road that intersects the photo. Peru's health minister announced an investigation July 30 into whether Peru had failed to properly classify more than 27,000 deaths as having been caused by the novel coronavirus. Already among the world's highest, the country's official death toll from the disease could more than double with the new figure. Here's a news ticker under which there's a trio of very short one-paragraph articles. Census count will be cut short. The U.S. Census Bureau announced August 3 it will end field data collection by the end of September, 1 month earlier than previously stated. The Bureau said the change should not affect results, but civil rights groups argue it will make underserved populations harder to accurately tally. Work begins on disputed Indian temple. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi hailed the dawn of a new era August 5 as workers laid the foundation stone for a controversial temple on the site of a demolished mosque. Erecting a temple on the spot, said to be the birthplace of the deity Ram, has long been a goal of Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party. Trump skirts Congress on DOD appointee. President Donald Trump appointed controversial retired Brigadier General Anthony Tata to a Pentagon position August 2, after Tata withdrew his congressional nomination for a more senior post. Although the new role does not require Congress's approval, it could allow Tata to take on higher-profile jobs. Within the brief news, good question. Why are so many nations going to Mars this summer? Traveling to Mars is usually a lonely business, with a single spacecraft taking off from a single launch pad for the 7-month trip to the Red Planet. That appeared to be the case again July 30, when NASA's Perseverance rover roared off the pad at Cape Canaveral atop an Atlas V rocket. But this time the ship will have plenty of company. July 19, the United Arab Emirates made its first bid to join the Mars game, launching the 3,000-pound, 10-foot-tall Amal, or HOPE, spacecraft on a mission to orbit Mars for at least 2 years while studying its atmosphere. 4 days later, China launched its Tianwen-1, or Questions to Heaven, spacecraft, a 3-part ship with an orbiter, a lander, and a 6-wheel, 529-pound rover. And a fourth mission, a joint Russian-European project, ExoMars, carrying a rover of its own, was also planned for this summer, though it's been postponed to 2020 because of engineering problems with its parachute and avionics. So why all the interest in Mars, and why right now? The timing issue has everything to do with planetary mechanics. As they fly their differing solar orbits, Earth on the inner track, Mars on the outer, the distance between the two worlds is forever changing. At their greatest remove, when they are on opposite sides of the Sun, they're up to 250 million miles apart. But once every 2 years, they line up on the same side of the Sun with just 35 million miles separating them. This summer, just such an alignment's taking place, dramatically slashing interplanetary travel time to the current 7-month itinerary. So that explains the when question. The why part is because of Mars's tantalizing, potentially biological history. The surface of the planet's etched with dry riverbeds, stamped with ancient sea basins, marked by deep depressions that could only indicate long-vanished water. Perseverance is landing in one such place, the Jezero crater, north of the Martian equator, which is lined with both inflow and outflow channels, indicating it was once a vibrant sea. Previous rover analyses in similar locations discovered chemicals and compounds that form only in the presence of water, proving Mars was once, like Earth, exceedingly wet. Now, the mission is to look for actual fossilized organisms or even signs of extant microbial life. To that end, Perseverance is the most ambitious of the new spacecraft and is actually just the first part of a multi-part mission. During its explorations, it will collect Martian soil samples in sterile titanium tubes and set them neatly on the ground, awaiting another spacecraft that could leave Earth as early as the 2026 alignment, collecting the samples and fly them home for analysis. Finding life on Mars would be an epical discovery. The bragging rights that go with being first to make the find is part of what makes the planet the hot new destination it has become. That article was by Jeffrey Kluger. Now, under wildlife, invasive interventions. As of July 28, Florida authorities removed 5,000 invasive Burmese pythons, which prey on native species, from the Everglades. Here are other eradication efforts, and this is by Alejandro de la Garza. There's a photograph here of a python. One sees its strikingly beautiful head with the stripes in various shades of off-white and gray and tan and brown rippling throughout its body. Helicopter hogs, Authorities in Arkansas killed nearly 700 feral hogs during a 68-hour helicopter operation, according to a March press release. Wild swine costs the state millions of dollars in crop damage every year. Fish fence. Kentucky officials commissioned a bioacoustic fish fence to control the spread of invasive Asian carp in 2019. The system, which is in a $7 million three-year field trial, emits noise within a wall of strobe-lit bubbles. Bug battle. To combat the invasive emerald ash borer beetle, the U.S. Department of Agriculture released parasitoid wasps that target the bug starting in 2007. As of 2018, wasps have been released in 26 states. Here is another trio of one-paragraph articles from News Ticker. Hong Kong elections postponed. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, an ally of Beijing, said legislative elections scheduled for September would be postponed by a year, citing a recent surge in coronavirus cases in the city. Pro-democracy activists said it was an attempt to slow their momentum after the imposition of a harsh national security law. DHS tracked protesters, press. Amid demonstrations in Portland, Oregon, the Department of Homeland Security created intelligence reports on protesters and journalists, the Washington Post reported July 30. After the news broke, Brian Murphy, acting DHS Undersecretary for Intelligence and Analysis, was reassigned. Former Spanish king flees country. Spain's former king Juan Carlos reportedly left the country for a luxury resort in the Dominican Republic August 3 amid a corruption scandal over his financial dealings while monarch. In a letter published on the royal website, Juan Carlos said he had left Spain because of public repercussions. Now under the milestones column, died Herman Cain, conservative original. At a 1996 political event at Sylvia's Soul Food Restaurant in Harlem, a man in the crowd shouted out something that changed Herman Cain's life. Black Republicans? There's no such thing. The remark so angered Cain, then an independent, that he switched his registration. And over the next quarter century, the child of the segregated South and former head of the National Restaurant Association became one of the country's best-known black Republicans, even running for president in 2012. So committed to his party was Cain that he flew to Tulsa, Oklahoma, for President Donald Trump's June 20 return to the campaign trail, despite health warnings. As candidates, Cain and Trump were in many ways cut from the same cloth. Neither was elected to any political post before running for the White House. They shot from the hip and campaigned in slogans. Both faced allegations of sexual harassment and other inappropriate behavior. Both denied the claims, though they proved disqualifying for Cain. Both were savvy exploiters of media, often saying things they knew would draw outrage and thus attention. Indifference, if not hostility, toward precedent and fact was a cornerstone of their strategies, not a flaw. At that indoor rally in Tulsa, Cain, a cancer survivor, posed for pictures without wearing a mask and sat in the packed stands. On June 29, he tested positive for COVID-19. He was hospitalized July 1. July 30, his aides announced Cain had died at age 74. That article was by Philip Elliott. More milestones. Died John Hume, Northern Irish politician and Nobel laureate who helped end decades of sectarian violence. August 2 at 83. Connie Culp, who became the first U.S. face transplant recipient in 2008, July 29, at 57. NYC journalist and novelist Pete Hamill, August 5, at 85. Completed, China's Beidou navigation satellite system, which could compete with U.S. GPS, July 31. Battered, U.S. East Coast by tropical storm Isaias, which made landfall in North Carolina August 3 as a hurricane. The storm killed at least 5 people and knocked out power for more than 2.8 million. Burned, more than 42 square miles by the Apple Fire in Southern California as of August 5. Ordered a curfew in Melbourne for 6 weeks as part of tough social distancing rules announced August 2 after a spike in COVID-19 cases. Detected dozens of COVID-19 cases on 2 cruise ships, one in Norway, one in Tahiti, just weeks after cruises restarted. Splashed down. NASA astronauts Robert Behnken and Douglas Hurley in a SpaceX capsule August 2 after the first manned trip to the International Space Station by a private company. The brief business now playing at the drive-in. Bands, weddings, anything by Andrew R. Chow. Bri and Lindsay Leverton had their dream wedding all planned out. In April, they were going to get married at a century-old mansion in downtown Austin with their guests sipping cocktails on a veranda by the pool. Instead, they found themselves 20 miles south of town tying the knot at a drive-in on a dirt road surrounded by cows. A formation of cars blasted their horns in delight. When our wedding planner asked us about getting married at a drive-in, we looked at each other and said, "That sounds insane," Lindsay says. The coronavirus has upended countless minor and major life events over the past few months. While many of these plans were canceled, a surprising share migrated to the drive-in movie theater, where social distancing via cars and pickup trucks is the norm. These theaters have scrambled to pivot their entire business model in the face of disappearing film releases and have unwittingly become catch-all communal hubs across the country. Drive-ins are being contacted like they used to be for everything in the community, says filmmaker April Wright, who directed the documentary Going Attractions, the definitive story of the movie Palace. They're hosting church services, weddings, graduations, dance recitals, concerts, stand-up comedy. Shifts to events like outdoor weddings and smaller-scale concerts serve as creative ways to stay afloat in an industry that was unforgiving before the pandemic. The number of drive-ins in the U.S. has continuously dwindled, especially as home and handheld entertainment command more and more attention. Now increased costs, a delayed film slate, and potential competition from pop-ups. The Tribeca Film Festival, for example, is programming drive-in experiences at beaches, sports stadiums, and even Walmart parking lots, are making some theaters skeptical they can last through the crisis. A lot of us are really struggling, says Nathan McDonald, owner of the 66 Drive-In in southwestern Missouri. If movies continue to be pushed, I'll probably close in late August. Some 300 independent drive-ins operate across the U.S. They typically make most of their money during the summer when students are on break and blockbusters roll in every weekend. But this year's tentpole films, From Mulan to Wonder Woman 1984, have been repeatedly delayed thanks to the continued closure of major indoor theater chains like AMC and Cinemark. As drive-ins opened for the season, they first turned to throwback classics like E.T. and Jaws, hoping to capitalize on nostalgia. Such films have produced mixed results for theaters. At the 66 drive-in, the average number of cars on a given night has dropped from 225 to 120. You can easily sit from the comfort of your couch and watch these films, McDonald says. Instead of waiting for new blockbusters to salvage their businesses, many theater owners have taken advantage of other event space closures. We are trying to substitute those new films for concerts or comedy shows so we can bring in relatively similar revenue, says Joe Calabro, president of the Circle Drive-In near Scranton, PA. The stream of a Garth Brooks show aired at hundreds of drive-ins across the country sold out. So the Circle turned to local musicians, whose normal gigs have been stripped away. Chris Shrive, a singer-songwriter from Old Forge, Pennsylvania, opened his band's show from the concession stand roof to overlook 450 cars, to see people barbecuing on the tailgates of their trucks, laughing, meeting people parked 18 feet away. It was awe-inspiring, Shrive says. This just might be the new normal. Basking in the crowd was Sherry Sikowski, who was seeing her first live concert since the start of the pandemic. There's been a lot of built-up frustration and animosity, says Sikowski, who estimates some 95% of the concert goers followed proper social distancing protocols. To be out amongst friends in a safe manner and to be able to experience the same show with them totally brings the community together. In Kings Mountain, North Carolina, the Hounds Drive-In has also thrived in its newfound role as a concert venue, especially because artists pay up front to use the space. They set up everything. We get our money. We get to keep all the concessions, owner Preston Brown says. I love it. His financial success has enabled him to turn his drive-in into a sort of commons. The Hounds has hosted dance recitals and pet organizations. It's welcomed more than a dozen graduating high school classes free of charge. Students receive their diplomas on the big screen as their families watched from their cars. According to Scott Neisler, mayor of Kings Mountain, the Hounds' active presence has resulted in a local economic boost. He also staged the city's 4th of July fireworks show there in order to celebrate the holiday safely. But a storybook ending for drive-ins might prove elusive. Their new outsized role in public life has not always ensured their financial health. The Benji's Drive-In Theater in Middle River, Maryland, has opened every day of some weeks with concerts, church services, and more. But the theater's operating at less than half capacity to promote social distancing and has taken on a much bigger staff to control safety and crowding. The public thinks we're a cash cow, says Benji's owner, D. Edward Vogel, but it's been very hard on us. Pop-up theaters emerging since the start of the pandemic, says Vogel, are breaking my heart. He's particularly worried about the 160 temporary drive-ins arriving in Walmart parking lots, featuring films chosen by Tribeca Enterprises in August. These spaces could further squeeze the independent operators. A representative for Walmart did not respond to a request for comment. At the 66 drive-in in Missouri, McDonald doubts he can make it to fall because of decreased capacity, a blank movie slate, and people bringing their own food instead of buying from the concession stand. His financial plight's worrisome to David Fowler, pastor of First United Methodist Church of Carthage, Missouri, who's been holding services from the snack bar roof every Sunday to growing crowds. His congregation appreciates seeing fellow worshipers in person as opposed to sitting at home alone. It's a bit of Americana I'd hate to see lost, says Fowler. In face of such hardships, drive-ins fight on for survival. In Buda, Texas, Doc's Drive-In has housed graduations, soccer watch parties, and two weddings, including the Levertons. In April, 45 cars rolled up on each side of a dirt road aisle. The couple, who paid $4,000 to book Doc's, swapped heels for boots and stood on a rickety stage, swatting away June bugs as an officiant married them from 6 feet away. It turned out the wedding we had was way, way better than anything we could have dreamed of, Lindsay says. After the ceremony, Airplane played on the big screen. Beneath the World heading, a vast explosion in Beirut piles tragedy on economic misery. There's a photo here by Hassan Ammar. It is devastation in a city. There's a pale blue sky in the background, but it's mottled with dark clouds of smoke or ash or other chemical assets. In the background, there's debris. There are high-rise buildings whose fronts are either damaged or demolished. There is junk everywhere in the streets. People are riding two-wheeled vehicles through these streets, motorbikes and smaller two-wheeled vehicles, mopeds probably. In some cases, two people are piled on these vehicles. One man, whose back is visible to the camera, he's dressed in brown, is carrying a tall girl or a young woman. And she just looks abrupt. Her eyes and her face look as if they're frozen with panic. There's an 18-wheeler that's empty. I don't know if it's coming in to try to load some of the debris and haul it off or if it got stalled there. And there are several people visible in this photo, and picking their way through the debris along this, what was a street apparently, but now it's just a clutter of demolition from buildings. Downtown Beirut was a mess of rubble, glass, and twisted rebar after a colossal explosion tore through the Lebanese capital August 4. The apparent accident left at least 135 people dead, wounded 5,000 others or so, and damaged so many buildings in the city that left hundreds of thousands homeless. Lebanese authorities blame the blast, so powerful it was felt 150 miles away in Cyprus, on the detonation of 2,750 metric tons of ammonium nitrate at Beirut's port. Throughout the night of August 4, radio presenters read out names of the wounded and missing as relatives scrambled to locate loved ones. Dozens were still missing at press time. The disaster added to the agony of a nation in its worst financial crisis since its 15-year-long civil war ended in 1990. One in three Lebanese people is unemployed. The Lebanese pound has lost 80% of its value against the dollar since October, and prior to the blast, grid electricity was available only for a few hours per day. We will start seeing children dying from hunger before the end of the year, said Save the Children in a recent report. As details of negligence in the run-up to the blast emerged, so did public anger at a government widely perceived as corrupt and incompetent. People are promising that today we mourn our martyrs and tomorrow we go back to the streets, said Fatima al-Mahmoud, a 22-year-old journalist. I hope that's true. That article was by Joseph Hinks. This is The View, with health being the caption, A Better Way to Test, by Dr. Ashkish K. Jha, J-H-A. Imagine spitting on a special strip of paper every morning and being told 2 minutes later whether you were positive for COVID-19. If everyone in the U.S. did this daily, we would dramatically drop our transmission rates and bring the pandemic under control. Schools and businesses could reopen with the peace of mind that infectious individuals had been identified. Michael Mina of the Harvard School of Public Health has been a major proponent of this idea and has pushed the idea of a test that costs as little as $1, which the government could mass produce and provide free of charge to everyone. In fact, these technologies exist today. Antigen tests are significantly cheaper and faster than the RT-PCR tests that are at the heart of America's current testing infrastructure, which is collapsing. As coronavirus cases surge around the country, laboratories are facing crippling shortages of key supplies and growing backlogs of samples. In many states, it can take 10 to 15 days to get test results, rendering these tests useless as a tool to prevent transmission and bring the pandemic under control. For most people, the peak period of infectiousness lasts about a week, and in the middle of this testing collapse, cities and towns are preparing to return millions of children to school this fall, with neither the intention nor the capability to test them. At this critical moment in our nation's fight against the COVID-19, it's time to radically rethink our approach to testing. The way forward is not a perfect test, but one offering rapid results. Over the past months, much of the conversation around testing has focused on accuracy. Tests have been touted for their high sensitivity, and the FDA requires diagnostic tests to correctly identify 95% of positive cases. The intuition behind this is clear. We want a test that will not miss positive cases and send infected individuals back into the world to spread the virus. These RT-PCR tests have become the backbone of our testing infrastructure. Yet their high cost and slow rate of analysis have undermined any attempt to put their high sensitivity to good use. CDC analyses suggest we are identifying only about 1 in 10 cases of COVID-19, mostly because we're testing so few people. By putting a premium on the accuracy of tests, we fail to test a majority of people with COVID-19, and these built-in delays actually undermine our ability to identify cases in a timely manner. The Quidel company, Quidel, has already received FDA approval for its antigen-based test on a strip of paper. Researchers are testing another $1 antigen test for widespread use in Senegal. Why, then, have these cheap and rapid tests not become the foundation of our national testing strategy? The answer lies in test sensitivity. Antigen tests require higher levels of virus than RT-PCR to return a positive result. There's been significant pushback from those who believe it would be irresponsible to widely use a test that might miss many positive cases. But the frequency of testing and the speed of results counter that concern. The RT-PCR tests are currently slowing laboratories to a crawl. If everyone took an antigen test today, even identifying only 50% of the positives, we would still identify 50% of all current infections in the country, 5 times the 10% of cases we're likely identifying now, because we are testing so few people. Accuracy could be increased through repeated testing and through the recognition that quicker test results would identify viral loads during the most infectious period, meaning those cases we care most about identifying would be less likely to be missed. Even better, we would be identifying these cases while they were still infectious, rather than 10 days later, when the virus might have already been transmitted repeatedly. Speed matters much more than test sensitivity in controlling a pandemic. The evidence makes clear it's time for a paradigm shift on testing. Cheap and rapid antigen testing can identify and prevent every cluster of COVID-19. It's time for the federal government to take strong leadership on directing our resources toward this new strategy. The U.S. has the ability to print paper strip antigen tests in massive numbers and to distribute them all over the country. If we do these things, we can move past 10-day delays, quash the current outbreaks, and ensure that we can safely go to work, do our shopping, and send our kids to school. Zha, the author, is K.T. Lee Professor of Global Health at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In September, he'll become Dean of Brown University School of Public Health. Short reads, highlights from stories, haunting memories. For her book, Wandering in Strange Lands, Morgan Jerkin spoke to a woman who played a key role in the police response to the Watts riots. She was traumatized, Jerkin writes. There were things that she chose to forget or that her body made her forget in order to protect herself and stay alive. A better internet, as hate speech, disinformation, and conspiracy theories continue to spread on internet platforms, it is time to get serious about regulating big tech companies, writes Zucked, that's Z-U-C-K-E-D, author Roger McNamee. Their stonewalling over the past 4 years has cost them the moral high ground. Blurred lines. As federal agents recently deployed to cities across the U.S., former U.S. Attorney Joyce White Vance issued the warning. The use of federal law enforcement capabilities against citizens exercising their rights, whether in Washington, D.C., Portland, or elsewhere, should not be equated with normal law enforcement activity. The View essay, captioned Society. America is failing moms, M-O-M-S. Let's start over. By Liz Lentz, that's L-E-N-Z. There's an illustration here. The backdrop appears to be a flag of the USA. There are red and white stripes, and then a big splotch of blue, atop which is a white star, atop which stands a woman holding a baby. The woman's dressed in a red top, a blue skirt, and the baby's dressed in white. So the theme there is red, white, and blue. In 1974, humorist Irma Bombeck published a syndicated newspaper column that looms over the lives of American mothers, whether they have read it or not. In When God Created Mothers, Bombeck describes God making a mother with the help of an angel. She has to be completely washable, but not plastic. Have 180 movable parts, all replaceable, God tells the angel. Run on black coffee and leftovers. Have a lap that disappears when she stands up. A kiss that can cure anything from a broken leg to a disappointed love affair. And 6 pairs of hands. My mother, who homeschooled 8 children, saw that column as a mark of her valor. Not only did it hang on our wall at home, I grew up hearing it quoted in church sermons on Mother's Day. But once I became a mother, I came to hate that column. I think Irma Bombeck did us dirty. As the pandemic forces us to rethink almost every aspect of our society, from why we go into an office to how we set up a kindergarten classroom, allow me to suggest we reassess the very foundation of our society, motherhood. Motherhood is valorized in American culture because we do not want to admit the truth. We have built an entire economy on the backs of unpaid and poorly paid women. Even as gender roles have shifted in the U.S., the expectation that the mother will be the parent primarily responsible for maintaining the household and taking care of the children, no matter what else she has on her plate, is still as true today as when Bombeck wrote her column. Never has this been clearer than during the pandemic. Although in 2017, 41% of mothers were the sole or primary breadwinner for their family, and an additional 23.2% brought home at least a quarter of their total household earnings. The loss of most outside support, from school, from camp, from daycare, has meant that mothers are the ones picking up the slack. A recent study of about 60,000 U.S. households published in the academic journal Gender, Work, and Organization showed that in heterosexual couples where both partners were employed, mothers have reduced their work hours 4 to 5 times more than fathers. There's no reason to believe this will get better, and plenty of reasons to suspect it will get worse, as school districts announce back-to-school plans that are all remote or a hybrid of online and in-person. The drive to reopen the economy without adequate child care will force women from the workforce in record numbers. Society will call it a choice, when in reality, it's a failure of the system. This is not a new problem, nor are the solutions a mystery. We have just chosen until now not to listen. It is time to abolish our conception of what it means to be a mother in America and rebuild it on a policy level. First, we need to normalize women receiving help with child care. We're the only industrialized nation without guaranteed paid parental leave, and for half of Americans, full-time daycare costs more than in-state college tuition. Additionally, other industrialized nations offer income supplements to help raise children or subsidies for child care costs. We do not. This disregard has continued even in these unprecedented times. As economist Betsy Stevenson pointed out to Politico, we gave less money to the entire child care sector than we gave to one single airline, Delta. The U.S. also ranks 26th in the world for access to preschool for four-year-olds and 24th for three-year-olds. But access to early childhood education rarely becomes a top policy priority. The implication is clear. Mom will take care of it. We also need to recognize the hypocrisy in giving mothers so little support when we make it difficult for women to choose when and whether to have children in the first place. Recently, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 to allow employers the right to deny insurance coverage for birth control. In addition to preventing some women from getting pain relief from endometriosis and heavy periods, this decision takes away a measure of control that can alter the entire trajectory of a woman's life. Meanwhile, states like Texas and Iowa, which had already put up barriers for women seeking abortions, tried to use the pandemic as a cover to further erode health care access for women by claiming the procedure was non-essential, a determination contradicted by leading health organizations. America has the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world, a number that rises significantly for people of color. And in addition to taking steps to combat this disgraceful problem, we should actually take into account the considerable risk that comes with pregnancy and childbirth and the long-term implications for those who are forced to become moms when they're not ready. A study by the research group ANSIRH, Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, at the University of California, San Francisco's Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health, found women who sought an abortion and were denied one were more likely to live below the federal poverty line, more likely to stay with abusive partners, more likely to suffer life-threatening complications during pregnancy and birth. Beyond letting women decide whether to have a baby, our government needs to pass legislation that would ensure that those who do become moms are paid the same as dads. According to the National Women's Law Center, for every dollar white dads made in 2018, Asian American and Pacific Islander moms made 89%, while white moms made 69%, Black moms made 50%, Native moms made 47%, and Latina moms made 45%. In 2017, Michelle J. Buttig, a professor of sociology at the University of Massachusetts, published a report, The Fatherhood Bonus and the Motherhood Penalty, in which she explained women's wages tend to decrease after they have kids, while men's tend to increase, though these shifts are not equal across income distributions. First, there's a wage penalty for motherhood of 4% per child that cannot be explained by human capital, family structure, family-friendly job characteristics, or differences among women that are stable over time, she wrote. Second, this motherhood penalty is larger among low-wage workers, while the top 10% of female workers incur no motherhood wage penalty. Part of the disparity between fathers and mothers may be due to employer discrimination, Buttig explained, citing research suggesting companies view dads as more competent and worthy of promotion than moms. Ideas of what make a good mother or a good father and an ideal worker matter, she writes. If mothers are supposed to focus on caring for children over career ambitions, they'll be suspect on the job and even criticized if viewed as overly focusing on work. But modern motherhood's also relentless. Not only do mothers in America today continue to spend more time on both child care and household chores than fathers do, despite men's increased involvement at home, they also spend more time with their children than they did in the 1970s, when Bombeck wrote, mothers had to have six pairs of hands, even as they worked full-time jobs. Unable to justify the cost of child care compared with their wages, or, in the case of a global health crisis, faced with no child care at all, women end up being the ones to walk away from work. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.